Claudette Colvin, civil rights pioneer, anti-racist hero, and a retired nurse. Welcome to Tell a Friend. So, to begin with, Ms. Colvin, could you, first of all, just tell me how you've been doing during this pandemic year and how you've been coping?
Well, here at Brookdale, we've been quarantined and we've been locked down, and I've been getting along good. They've been taking good care of me.
I'm glad to see that you're doing well, and you know, we're finally seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. So I invited you onto my show because you are this civil rights hero and pioneer, as I said in my introduction. And I really wanted to have you on the show because with my podcast, I highlight Black history, and it's heroes like yourself who I love having as a guest because I think you have so much knowledge and wisdom that I can share with my audience and learn myself. So I'll begin with my first question and ask you to take me back to Montgomery in the 40s and 50s and tell me what life was like for a young Claudette Colvin.
In Montgomery, Alabama? Everything was segregated in Montgomery, the school, the community, and the churches. Everything was segregated, and the transportation system was segregated. And in shopping downtown, you wasn't allowed to try on clothes in the dressing room. And you wasn't able to try on shoes. And there was white fountains and a colored fountain. Everything was completely segregated, and that was signs saying white only. You wasn't allowed to go in these stores.
And for a young girl navigating this segregated and racist environment, how did you, you know, wrap your head around all of it? How did you view yourself in that segregated world?
Well, you knew your parents taught you the do's and don'ts so you wouldn't get in any trouble. And you knew your boundaries. And if you didn't want to get into trouble, you didn't cross your boundaries. So some people did, and they were penalized. And some people didn't.
And Ms. Colvin, I have to say, when I was doing my research for this interview, I, you know, read a lot about you. And one thing that kept coming up was your love of history and how growing up you had always been interested in history, especially Black and African history. And we share that in common. I'm a historian and I study history at university. So I wanted to know, what was the history that you were learning at school, you know, from an early age? Who were the characters you were learning about?
Well, I learned from my history teacher. We learned about our heroes because there wasn't any books in the library. And in the Britannical Encyclopedia, there was only two African-Americans that got recognition. And that was Booker T. Washington, the educator, and George Washington Carver, the agriculture inventor. You know, he was supposed to have invented a lot of things, but didn't get credit for it. It's famous, he did a lot of research on the peanut. So anyway, then we talked about other activists like women. And the two women stood out to me the most was Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. And then we talked about the Black men at that time. The boys were mostly interested in Jackie Robinson breaking the baseball barrier. And some of the students who was interested in music and opera was thinking about Marian Anderson. And she wasn't allowed to sing in Constitutional Hall because of the color of her skin. And she had to sing in the Lincoln Memorial. So those were the things that we talked about. And we talked about Frederick Douglass, W.E. Du Bois. This, the teachers brought us this information. And my two instructors, Mrs. Geraldine Nesby and Mrs. Joseph Lawrence. Mrs. Joseph Lawrence was my social studies teacher. These two teachers, by the faculty members, said they was unorthodox in their teaching methods. So Mrs. Joseph Lawrence had us to subscribe. At that time, it was a little mini newspaper called The Current Events. We were learning about the struggle in Kenya. And so that's why I was so interested in history.
That's so wonderful to hear, because actually something that, you know, comes up time and time again today is the issue about what's on the curriculum and what Black history is being taught to students. And there's a lot of debate about whether there's enough Black history. But it's great to know that you were learning about the Mau Mau, because I'm actually Kenyan myself.
Yes. So
it's wonderful that they were teaching that history. But I wanted to ask you, when you went home, did you continue these discussions around race and around, you know, politics with your family?
Yes, because there was a lot of injustice that was taking place in the Black community. We were treated as a second-class citizens. And when I was in the ninth grade, something happened. And I don't want to jump ahead of you. That was one of the reasons why I got interested. One of my classmates, when I was in the ninth grade, Jeremiah Reeves was arrested for being a serial rapist. And he was on death row, and he was a minor. And they held him on death row until he was old enough to be electrocuted.
And, you know, how did all of that make you feel? I mean, you know, I say this cautiously, not wanting to ask an obvious question, but, you know, I struggle to put myself in your shoes back then, you know, where you're taking in your environment, where, you know, you're in a segregated society. You know, how did that impact you emotionally and spiritually?
Well, I thought it was a very unfair. And because I saw the double standard, because when a white man was arrested for the same crime, he got off scot-free. And this young man, this was an adult white man, raped a white Black girl. And the judge didn't think that Black girl was attractive enough for a white man to rape her. Directed Black girl, but this young man was held, he was a minor, and he was treated as an adult. So that was unfair, and we sent letters to Jeremiah, and so, you know, to try to give him support, and we don't know whether he would receive the letters or not, but we did. So that was when I was in the ninth grade. So you saw so much injustice as a child till you wonder why the adult was afraid to speak out.
Now, before we get into speaking about your historic day of resistance, I want to first of all just paint a picture for, you know, our audience and, you know, ask you, what was the music you were listening to, you know, at this early age? And, you know, what was the food you were eating? Just paint a picture of, you know, the culture at the time.
The music that I was listening to, well, there was Sam Cooke's, and I listened to a lot of Sam Cooke music. And, well, at that time, and it was rock and roll. It was rock and roll. And, you know, Elvis Presley was on. We had a lot of Elvis Presley. And because we didn't have the radio station, I listened to a lot of Hank Williams. He was a white country singer. Yes. We didn't have a radio station. So a lot of music was country music, white music, country music. I love Hank Williams, though. I like his music.
And you know, how did you, you know, did you go out to clubs and dances with your friends?
We would have record hops, but I wasn't a good dancer. We would have record hops, and you were the best dancer. I was a wallflower. I wait till the end, and then everybody joining at the end. And at that time, the cha-cha was coming out. The cha-cha has, you know, the cha-cha. You heard talk of the cha-cha? The Latin dance, the cha-cha.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but we didn't do it the Latin way. We did the rock and roll way. And that I didn't get, because I was going 1, 2, cha-cha-cha, 1, 2, cha-cha. I didn't get it. I could never get it the rock and roll way, the cha-cha. No, that was good. And then later, as I, you know, the twist came in. Chubby Checker, the twist, the twist. And I took all great twists. Yes, Chubby Checker.
And
everybody knows the blues, but you don't, blues is a slow brew, but the teenagers like the twist.
And I have to ask you, in your, you know, day-to-day life, you know, whether it was going out with your friends or in school, did you have much interaction with, you know, white people, white students? You know, was that, with their that interaction?
Oh, no, but because I lived on, I tell people, because the little don't, okay, this is a long story. I'm going to try to put it together the best I can, be as simple as I can. I lived in between two white communities, Capitol Heights in the front and Highland Garden in the back. Capitol Heights was a white working class community, and Highland Garden was a low-income white community. And we lived on this little elevated land that no one wanted, that was a seed company on this land. And since a lot of African-Americans, well, we were called Negroes of color at that time, was coming from the rural area, they didn't mind. They just wanted a little plot of land, right, to build a home. So a lot of homeowners was on King Hill. It's only three blocks, three long blocks. And I had, and that was the Upper Weetonka Highway that separated the white community from King Hill. So on one side, that was color people or Negroes couldn't buy property across the highway. Had to ride, you know, on the one side. That was the Mason-Dixon line, the highway, the Upper Weetonka Highway. So I just recognized their faces and the color of their hair, but I did not know their name. And they, you know, we made faces at them. And they threw spitballs at us and they threw water balloons. But our parents told us not to fight them, run from them, because if we fought them, they will put us in the reformatory school. And we know that was a school for hard labor. So we were frightened. We didn't want to go to school where you had to do hard labor. So we didn't fight with the white kids, but every day I had to pass them in order to get off the hill, in order to get off the street where I live and cross the highway to get where I'm going. I had to pass white people.
Now, in order,
but we didn't have to act. We didn't have to act.
I was going to mention that in the interviews that I've seen of yours, and you know, doing my reading, I read that, you know, at school you were even, you know, quite a radical back then, and you used to wear your braids. Could you tell me that story?
Well, that story with us anyway. Well, right now I'm wigging it. But back in the day, I'll describe the texture of my hair. I have that little soft nappy hair. And little soft nappy hair is hard to keep straight. You need the coarse hair to take the, because then we didn't have the perm and all the chemicals that African Americans have now. We didn't have none of that now, back then in the day. We only had what we call a hot comb and pomade. So my hair wouldn't stay straight no way. So anyway, I would say it didn't stay straight anyway. So I decided to go, not to worry about it. And I went to school natural, and the children thought I was really crazy. They said, what? And they was girls were telling me, you're gonna lose your boyfriend. You're gonna lose your boyfriend. So they go, the boys are gonna be calling you nappy headed. So I didn't care. I didn't care. That didn't faze me then.
And when you were wearing your braids, were you wearing it, you know, trying to make a political statement? Were you wearing it to
celebrate your identity? When I was wearing it that way, I just got tired of straightening it. And then later, I just kept on wearing it. And they were saying, when you gonna stop wearing it? I said, I'm gonna stop wearing it with everything. When Black people straighten out their mess, but I didn't mean that straighten out their mess, but I meant that when Black people, you know, find their own identity and stop worrying about, you know, trying to emulate the white woman, because your hair wasn't gonna get straight. It's what since I was on King Hill and being around and seeing these white people every day, I knew our hair wasn't gonna look like theirs anyway, no matter how you straighten it. It wasn't gonna look like theirs, not with no hot comb. So anyway, that's what I was talking about.
Even that small act, I mean, you were saying there that at school you'd get ridiculed from students, but the fact that you stood your ground, you were showing, you know, that early resistance, and you were showing that, you know, you were determined to, you know, live your life, do, you know, make your own decisions, regardless of what other people said or felt. And I use that to segue into, you know, the historic day, March 2nd, 1955. And I was wondering if you could talk to me, you know, through that day and, you know, what happened before the bus, because I think, it'd be nice to understand how your day led up to that event.
Well, it's what we were speaking about, it what we just said. We were studying about the whole month of February was, it was illegally then, it was just a week, but the faculty members said, since Negroes were deliberately left out of American history, we should study it for the whole month. So I had the whole month to talk about all the injustice that was happening nationally and locally. So anyway, that's why. And I tell the reporter, as someone just says, you're not the first reporter, but reporter asked me, why did you move when the bus driver asked you to give up your seat? I said, history had me glued to the seat. And then the reporter said, how is that? I said, it felt as though Harriet Tubman's hand was pushing me down on one shoulder and Sojourner Truth's hand was pushing me down on another. And I said, these two iconic women, I had studied about their lives and their struggle and how brave they were. So it was no way I was gonna let these Harlem Gardeners, at that time the bus audience, get away with forcing me to give my seat up.
So you're sat on the bus, a white woman has come on, and now you're being asked to move. And you said you felt history, you know, pushing you down and, you know, telling you to remain seated and stand your ground. could you tell me what was going on in your mind as, you know, all of this was unfolding? Were you calm? Were you, you know, with your heart racing? What was going on?
No, I was a teenager. I would tell you, the Highland Gardeners were people that I was familiar with their faces and their hair color, but we didn't interact. You understand? So they wasn't strangers. They wasn't strangers. And the students in the back of me, during the altercation, one lady, I never will forget her. Her name was Margaret Johnson. She said, one of the white students said, "Well, you got to get up because it's the law. You got to get up because of the law." And Margaret Johnson said, "She doesn't have to do anything but stay black and die." And so that made me feel, that gave me a little more support. And the students, you know, they gave me support because we all knew what the passionists, my classmates that lived in my community, they knew my mindset and they gave me support. So I didn't move and they didn't get off the bus. They didn't move either.
I can only imagine.
They didn't get out of that seat and run off the bus, what I'm speaking about.
They stayed there with
you. They remained seated. Yes.
And I wonder, you know, what the reaction would have been from your parents. You know, as a parent, you know, you hear that your child is, you know, starting this movement, starting this, you know, this defiance. What was the reaction when you got home and your parents learned about, you know, your defiance on the bus?
Oh, my dad said, you know, we don't have a strong R in the South. So my dad said, you know, well, he called me by my nickname and said, you put us in a lot of danger. And I said that these people were picking at me. They was picking at me, you know, they were harassing me. That's what I told daddy. I didn't say harass. I said they were picking on me. These white children was picking on me and the bus driver. And then they called the police. So my dad sit up all night shot with a shotgun. You know, a loaded shotgun, not an empty shotgun. Because my dad was a hunter. Well, you couldn't, Negroes at that time, all color people, couldn't get ammunition until hunting season, but dad always kept enough shell, we call them shells, to put in the shotgun. So he loaded his shotgun and sit there waiting, because he said, if they come, I knew my dad was a good shot. I know the Klan was going to take me out, because dad would have took some of them out.
And I wonder, you know, at that time, did you realize the significance of your act? Did you, you know, realize, you know, how important that was? Or to you, were you still just standing, you know, by your conviction?
No, at the time I told you, it was just the Highland Gardeners, the low income white people that on the altercation between the adult white people jumped in it and the bus driver, which wasn't supposed to be, because I wasn't breaking the law. I was sitting in the seat that was assigned for colored people. But because of Jim Crow, the bus driver could ask you to get to release your seat. And in order for the white lady to sit, it had to be four people to move because the law was that a white person could sit behind a Negro or color person. They had to sit in front of a white person, of a color person, a Negro person, to show superiority and didn't want the Negro to feel inferior. Because you see, here in Birmingham, in Montgomery, we didn't even have the movable signs like they had here in Birmingham. in Birmingham, maybe because it was a bigger city, maybe that's probably why, in a larger Black community, they had white on one side, other sign, and color on the other. And it was movable. And as the, in different areas, depending on the population of the rider, the bus driver could move it so you wouldn't have no confusion. But we didn't have that in Montgomery. It was up at the top where the advertisement are, at the top of the bus, with an arrow pointing to the rear and an arrow pointing towards the front. So the bus driver had the power to move these signs. So I was, my anger was at the Highland Gardeners, but I did not know at the time everything was an impulsive act, and I did not know that it would evolve into a movement.
You know, that's something that has come up time and time again as I've been speaking to, you know, activists from different decades, you know, fighting different causes. You have these huge historical events that take place, and people don't realize the gravity of what's happening at the time. And, you know, as a history student, you know, taking all of this information in is fascinating for me. But I wanted to move on to talking about the court case that followed. And I was wondering if you could talk to my viewers a bit about the court case and your involvement in it.
The court case was called Ryder v. Gale because it was four women. Initially, it was five women, Ms. Janetta Reese, but she declined because and she almost got attorney Fred Gray disbarred because she didn't know, let him know, notify her husband that she was going to participate. And so there was a little friction going on there. But anyway, she declined. So we ended up with four women and two adults and two teenagers. Mrs. Susan McDonald, Ms. Aurelia Browder, who the case was named after, and Mary Lee Smith, and her name is Mary Lee Smith Ware now, and myself. And initially, they wanted to use Mrs. Parks as a spokesperson, but for the information that I received is that attorney Fred Gray came to New York to get advice from Robert Carter and Thurgood Marshall that that they need to get new plaintiffs, that they could hold Mrs. Parks was only arrested for misdemeanor and they could hold out another year. And they didn't know whether the protesters would be willing to stay off the bus another year because people don't realize with the transportation system, that system was all over the South, and that they had a bus boycott in Tallahassee, Florida, that was unsuccessful, and one in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was successful. So Dr. King had led this one successfully, and we had to lose. So they had to, attorney Fred Gray first asked volunteers from ministers, but the minister declined because that church was being bombed by the KKK. And a lot of their livelihood depended on that church. So anyway, they came back to myself and met the two teachers and the four, and well, the four women. And so that's why the case was, that's what the case went to the state, and then eventually it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court declared that segregated seating on the bus, segregated seating and transportation was unconstitutional.
I was asking about how the media was reporting on your case and you know, how they were reporting about, you know, your defiant moment on the bus.
About the defiant moment on the bus? I wasn't highlighting it too much. Most of the ministers, most of the people said that I was an unsung hero. And I was an unsung hero. But the media, most people don't know about Claudia Carver, not even in the Montgomery area. Most people know about Rosa Parks. They know about her, but they don't know about me. So that's what it is. And the four women, they don't know that most people think that Mrs. Parks, because she refused to give up her seat, that that ended segregation. They don't realize a lot of litigation took place because the segregationists had taken it to court, and it wasn't that easy. And a lot of brilliant attorneys had to fight it through the judicial system. And it wasn't just giving up the seat, not being arrested. And she wasn't on the case. She wasn't on the case. But that don't diminish anything about Rosa and her contribution to the movement. But I think the truth should be out there that the case was the four women. We were the one that brought it to a successful conclusion.
And, a lot of people, when they're looking at your case, looking at the case of Rosa Parks, which took place 9 months later, a lot of people talk about colorism and how you being of a darker complexion and not fitting, the image that they were trying to, achieve for the movement. In your own assessment, do you believe that's the case? Your story wasn't, promoted by the movement.
Color is in the African American community because white. I don't know whether it was the anthropologists or who made people believe that the white race area and people who had white features and you had that look, that image was considered more appealing to the white community than a dark complexion person.
I wanted to move on to talking about some recent events. Obviously, we've just ushered out the Trump era in America. And during Trump's reign, if you like, we saw the issue of race really come to the forefront again. And we saw a lot of, racism, overt racism, that America hasn't seen in a very long time. And I was wondering, what was your assessment of the Trump years and, the hostility that was brewed by his base?
Well, I think it was always there, but in the South, the more liberal white people now, and that minority didn't get a fair, was treated unfairly. But then the during the Trump era, he didn't emphasize it too much, about racism. He said he was the least racist person. But I think racism is mostly based now in the modern day racism based on the economy. As long as we are a minority and we got to depend on other people for our resources and our well-being, we're always going to see it, not as equal to them. Although there's just as many low-income white people, but they identify with the ruling class just because of their skin. But I think Trump used them. I think he really used them, to rant their fears. And the fear is that in the world today, the Caucasian people, I think that's global. I don't think Caucasian people with more people of color become wiser and educated, and knowing their system, that they're going to get a free pass like they have before. I don't think they can go into any country now and take over without giving something back. But before, they used to just go over and take over, and no consequences was no consequences whatsoever. And I think the fear is the threat of the rising up and the expectation of minorities. And minorities are getting educated. And I know most African Americans feel that education is the tool that you can use to uplift yourself. And I think that is their biggest fear, because as they have been taught that we couldn't, you know, that we didn't want a better life. But there's been rising expectation of people of color. And it's not only African-American, all people of color. And another country that's in the global, you know, just from watching TV, China has come on the scene. Boy, and Chinese people don't play around. So I think that's a big problem. The Caucasian people going, in other words, what I'm going to say, they're going to have to compete. And before, they didn't have to compete. Everything was handed. They got everything easily. I think the word they use, what is it? Privileged white people? Is that the word they use?
Yeah.
I think that's the end of it. And that's a big...
Well, I think you bring up an amazing point there, where you talk about, you know, race and class. And I think that's so important, as you're saying, you know, to... you know, look at racism with that class dimension, and look at how, you know, a lot of Trump's base are actually, you know, victim to a lot of the economic pressures that a lot of people, you know, a lot of Black and, you know, other people of color are, you know, victim to. But the difference is they vote based on their, you know, their color allegiances. They vote on what's best, you know, for their white privilege. I wanted to ask you, what was your assessment of the Black Lives Matter movement that was taking place, a resurge over the summer?
Well, I was glad that the Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Movement came out and spoke out and was able to express themselves, you know, get their voice known. So because there was too much injustice going on openly, and especially after George Floyd's death, I don't know, it was too much. It was too much openly. That was a 21st century George openly. I don't know, I don't understand that. Really can wrap my mind around it. And, you know, it's so depressing too, to know that, you know, the law enforcement people are supposed to protect you, and they go out the way to harm you. So I just couldn't wrap my mind around it. I don't even try to. And I'm glad that the young people fighting for police reform. There need to be some. You're supposed to be treated equally, you know.
And, you know, how do you feel when you look at the racial injustices that are taking place today, and you think back to 1955, where, you know, a 15-year-old Claudette Colvin was fighting the same issues back then, you know, does it make you feel, you know, a little bit depressed that, you know, things aren't improving as quick as we'd want them to?
I think that a lot have changed, but a lot still remain the same. But because no one had really, and this country had really acknowledged that slavery was wrong. They didn't acknowledge that. I don't think there's anything they want. They tried to, but nothing has been said, to address the whole Negro race. That slavery was wrong. And it, you know, so I think until we address that, and that the anthropologist was wrong too, that we are not the missing link to the chimpanzee, right? A lot of them try to pretend that we were closer to the the anthropologists tried to justify that we were the closest to the chimpanzee, and a lot of scientists believe that we could learn and that we was inferior as a race of people. As a race of people, we are inferior. So all of this has to be addressed until we come to mind is that we are all on this planet and there's no such thing as an inferior human being. You, from day one, you have to learn. I don't care if you're the king, I don't care if you're the peasant, you still have to learn. So if you don't live in a healthy environment and you don't have the resources and provided by an adult person, you're going to remain the same. So in the same system, I mean, in the same status. I mean. But we as human beings, until the white or the Caucasian people acknowledged that, it was always there. But some of the liberal people, they just said a little bit. They wanted, in other words, they wanted to get the best of us, but they wanted to leave. I'm like this old movie, or this old Clint Eastwood movie, but the African Americans are the bad, the good, and the ugly. But the white, the liberals just only want the good people, and the good of what happened to us, I want to inject this, all the good African American, all intelligent African American, and all the successful African American professionals, they left the ghetto, and they aligned themselves with the Caucasian people and the white community and left us behind. And I think that was our big mistake. What we got to do now is with what we've seen happening now. And we it didn't get exposed until that was the only thing I can say Trump exposed us to, that the lack of the cohesiveness in the Black community. So the Black Lives Matter, that's why I'm so proud of them, so they can unite the Black family together. And if we all get together on the same page, we can defeat this racism.
I think that's, a great point that you make there, about the importance of, actually taking the present day struggles and actually contextualizing it in the longer history, not only looking at now, but looking, slavery, looking at the way anthropology was set up and how, academia in general was set up to facilitate racism. But before we conclude, I want to finish on a quick fire round of questions. So I'm going to read out a statement and ask you to fill in the blank. So the first
fill
one.
Fill in the blank.
Yeah, to complete the sentence.
Okay.
So the first one is, the greatest misconception about me is?
That I was crazy when I reacted.
My biggest regret is?
That I didn't get the recognition at an early age.
I am most fearful of?
Most fearful of racism.
I am most proud of?
My grandchildren. I'm most proud of my grandchildren. They'll reap the fruit of my labor.
And finally, I want to be remembered for?
For my contribution, and I was the spark that ignited the Montgomery bus boycott.
Miss Claudette Colvin, thank you so much for joining me on Tell a Friend. And I want to tell you, this has been the fulfillment of a dream to be able to speak with you. So I thank you so much. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.